Welcome to the 2018 Peak Halftime Report.
Peak Wealth Management proudly presents Finding True Wealth with Nick Hopwood, where we believe by providing education and guidance, we help our clients make sound financial decisions, which ultimately puts them on a path towards their definition of true wealth. Now, here is your certified financial planner professional and founder of Peak Wealth Management, Nick Hopwood.
Today we're joined by Benjamin Levine, CFA, and Chief Investment Officer at 3D Asset Management. 3D is one of our premier UMAX institutional strategists. We've invited Ben on the show today to discuss the markets and the economy and what's happened year to date and where he sees the rest of the year as far as opportunities and risks are concerned. And I hope as you're listening to what Ben has to say, it'll be clear to you why we leverage the resources of the UMAX platform, where I can be your certified financial planner and Ben and his team can be your chartered financial analyst. Without further ado, let's bring in Ben. Hey, Ben, welcome to Finding True Wealth. It's great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Can you start by giving us a history of your career, a little background about yourself?
I started my career in 1997 on the institutional consulting side. I worked my way over to become a senior executive at Wilshire Associates, a large institutional consulting firm focused on pension plans, foundations, endowments. And that's where I got a lot of my initial experience on the investment side, on the institutional investment side. And then my wife and I moved out to Boston, and I started a career at Battery March Financial, which at the time had been owned by Legg Mason. And that's where I picked up a lot of my quantitative equity research and portfolio management experience. I was a portfolio manager at Battery March. And in 2015, I joined 3D as their chief investment officer, focusing on their ETF model portfolios. And for me, it was a transition because I had spent most of my career at that point on the institutional side. And joining 3D, this was my first experience working with retail advisors such as yourself. So it's a different world, but I think it's a much more rewarding world, marketplace to be working with. But what I like to say is I bring an institutional perspective to ETF model management when working with advisors.
Well, I'm glad to have you here for our 2018 halftime report. I'm looking forward to your analysis of the first half of the year and maybe a little preview of what to expect for the rest of the year.
Sure.
So you mentioned 2015, you began working with retail advisors. I guess that's me, retail advisor. And we were making a transition at that same time. So we kind of landed with Peak and 3D with TD Ameritrade all at the same time, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So far this year, the U.S. has been outperforming the rest of the world compared to international and other fixed income. So why do you think that's the case?
So that outperformance really began in March. And it began with some heightened trade war rhetoric. President Donald Trump had gotten some key wins with Republican-led tax reform legislation, and it sort of got to a point where one of the promises he made was to reduce the trade imbalances that we have with the rest of the world, primarily with China. That rhetoric started an initial sell-off in international assets. We saw a rally in the dollar. I think global investors were also starting to catch up to the reality of the Fed. Even though the Fed started tightening rates as far back as 2016, the market was starting to incorporate what the sort of knock-on effects would be from further tightening. And as a result, the dollar, which had sold off quite a bit throughout 2017 and the first couple of months of 2018, started to rally again. And investors are also questioning the global growth story. So business sentiment indicators, whether it's the purchasing manager indicators that are tracked globally or the German business IFO index, there was a sense that things were starting to turn down globally. And a lot of these things, along with some local market issues in Argentina, Brazil, Turkey, started the way, I think, on international asset classes. And the U.S., which sort of behaved as the safe haven asset or safe haven market among the global markets, started to benefit from that sentiment again. And that started roughly around March. And since then, we've seen straight outperformance of the U.S. markets, both in equities and fixed income versus the rest of the world.
And you wrote that the U.S. is like a sea of tranquility.
Well, right now it is, because unlike the rest of the world, the U.S. macro indicators look fairly strong, whether it's business sentiment conditions, whether it's employment. I think the global growth story or the U.S., the global growth story remains firmly intact for the U.S., even if it's not so much for the rest of the world.
So the leading economic indicators index for the U.S. is strong, like you just said. And I believe I read that at this level, it would suggest that there's only a 5% chance of recession in the next year in the U.S.
I saw a poll of economists recently polled that suggested that recession risk isn't expected until 2020 or 2021. But there again, take that with a grain of salt, because as far as I can tell, no consensus polling of economists have ever shown that they can predict a recession.
It's funny you say that, because I like to look at the Atlanta Fed GDP Now website, and I probably look at it once a week, and you can see the Atlanta Fed number changing from week to week, but when it shows the economists, it's like it never changes. Mm-hmm. It's always just 3% forever. They never seem to change their expectations.
No, but I think for them, what they're sort of taking into account is that we're at peak employment conditions right now. The Fed is embarked on a tightening schedule. Historically, Fed tightening is typically felt across the broader economy 12 to 18 months following the initial tightening. So by their calculations, they feel that the combination of the Fed tightening, higher commodity prices, and peak employment will likely mean the end of our current cycle by right around 2020. Now, initially they were projecting 2019, but I think with the Republican tax legislation and increased spending by Congress, that date has been pushed out to 2020.
Okay, so you're bringing up some important points, talking about the Fed raising rates. And usually, they're trying to raise rates to battle inflation. I mean, mm-hmm. Do we see inflation as a problem? And do you worry about our fixed income investments with the Fed tightening?
So earlier in the year, we talked about the forces of cyclical reflation versus the new normal secular disinflation. When we talk about new normal, which was a phrase first coined by PIMCO in the early 2000s, it's this idea that post-2008 financial crisis, we've entered into a world that has much higher debt levels, excess global manufacturing capacity, and aging demographics, meaning that the workplace is getting older. Young people aren't replacing retirees as at a ratio that we enjoyed post-World War period. So that, in theory, should keep a lid on long-term inflationary forces. That's not to say that we can't have cyclical reflation. And so far, what we've seen really since Brexit of mid-2016 is we've seen a cyclical rebound in not just growth expectations, but also inflation. And the Fed first started to respond to that back in 2015, 2016, when the whole goal of the Fed is to normalize rate policies from the emergency levels that they've maintained since the financial crisis.
Because in 2020, when the next recession comes,
they want to have enough ammunition
to be able to lower rates again.
So certainly we're seeing a spout of cyclical reflation. I think core PCE is expected to get to roughly 2%. It is ultimately inflation. Headline inflation is really driven by the volatility in commodities. So higher oil prices are going to be driving near-term headline inflationary numbers. If we see oil prices kind of come off from their $70 barrel levels that we've seen more recently, then certainly that year-over-year pressure on inflation will subside. The key is with core PCE, and that's really driven more by inputs beyond raw materials, primarily labor. And so economists are trying to keep track of wage, signs of wage price pressures. And those are what ultimately will forward into Core PCE. And certainly that's what the Fed is looking at right now. But, you know, the Fed also is wedded to the Phillips curve, the historical relationship between employment and inflation. And they feel like, you know, for them, the debate right now is what is the natural rate of employment that can, you know, sustain economic growth without causing inflation. And I think they're worried right now that sort of we're beyond that sustainable level. Yeah.
So you're mentioning wage inflation. And I want to say, you know, that 10% correction that we had from January 26th to February 6th, they're right about there. Mm-hmm. One of those big drops was on a Friday when the jobs number came out, like an 800-point drop, and another big one on the next Monday, where the jobs number was actually good. There were a lot of new jobs mm-hmm. created, but the wage inflation was picking up, and the market was really scared from this inflation perspective.
Yeah, it was a 2.9% year-over-year rise in the wage component of the employment report, and that's what initially caused the sell-off, because it essentially cemented this idea that the Fed is on track to tighten rates beyond, I think, what the market had been expecting or what had been priced in. Into fixed income. So you saw a big sell-off in the fixed income markets. The 10-year rose, broke 3%, and has kind of moved back and forth. Right now, I think based on today's close, it closed just under 2.9%, around 2.8-ish%. But inflation got repriced into the markets, both on the equity and the fixed income side. So you saw both equities and fixed income sell-off. Since then, the wage information, the wage price pressures have been mixed. It's more anecdotal at this point. Companies having a hard time finding good qualified labor to meet their needs and so forth. And ultimately, the question is how is that going to manifest itself in terms of wage cost components, and how much of that can get passed on to the end consumer?
Mm-hmm. So I want to shift gears for just one second. At 3D, you guys use what we call factor investing, right? Also known as smart beta type strategies. Mm-hmm. So that would include quality, momentum, growth, value, small caps, stuff like this, volatility. Mm-hmm. You know, what have you been seeing this year with different factors?
So this has been a year that growth continues to perform better than the broader markets. And growth can mean a number of things. When we talk about growth, we basically say, what segment of the market is growing faster than the market, is more profitable versus the market, is basically more successful.
So this year that'd be like technology, right?
Yes. So technology had been more or less a one-sided bet in 2017, where the tech sector as a whole just outperformed all the other sectors by a large margin. And this year, even though we saw a bit of a pullback around the February to April timeframe, that's when, you know, the data scandal with Facebook had come out. We saw some, you know, semiconductor earnings disappointments and so forth. So that sector had underperformed, but now it's come back. Facebook, I think, just hit a new high. So when we talk about factor-based investing from a growth standpoint, really what we're saying is what are the characteristics of a stock when aggregated with other stocks of similar characteristics perform in a sort of systematic fashion? That's what we mean by a factor. And in this case, when we're talking about growth, it can be, you know, capturing factors like, you know, high growth versus low growth, whether based on revenue or earnings. It can be, you know, companies that are experiencing positive sell side estimate revisions versus those that are experiencing negative. Another factor is just tracking the success of the stock price of a basket of successful stocks versus ones that have lagged the market, and that's what's referred to as momentum. But all these sort of have characteristics that, you know, that even though Facebook obviously is different from Amazon, which is different from Apple, which is different from Google, they all kind of share these same systematic characteristics that even though they're running in different businesses, their stock prices tend to behave similarly because they share common characteristics. And that's what we mean by factor-based investing.
Earlier this year, like on January 26th, a lot of people were making the argument that the PE ratio, you know, the multiple of the market, was starting to get a little stretched. Mm-hmm. And I kind of felt that same concern too. But since then, the market's been down, and also earnings have skyrocketed up 25%. So now the PE ratio is kind of back to normal, right? Could you comment on that?
Sure.
That ratio, and then how does the change recently affected how you think about the future?
Well, part of it's because of the tax bump.
Yeah.
So it's not just that corporate tax rates were lowered, but I think there was a more favorable depreciation schedule was also part of the legislation. So there you have what's called accelerated depreciation of capital spending, which means you kind of get a nice one-time bump from that from a tax treatment standpoint. I think the other issue too is you know, how broad-based is the earnings growth? Is it just limited to a handful of companies, as I alluded to earlier with the growth strategy, or is it more broad-based? Observers who are more cautious on the markets look at government measures of profitability and say they're not as robust as what, you know, S&P is reporting for earnings growth within the S&P 500 index. But regardless, I think the big debate right now is how much of the earnings growth that we're seeing in the markets is due to the tax reform legislation versus core operations. Like, are the core underlying metrics, the core underlying health of companies better such that they're going to experience both higher revenue growth, and with historically high profit margins, that'll manifest themselves more directly into earnings. And so, you know, how much of it is core versus how much of it is a tax bump? But regardless, analysts are projecting pretty strong earnings growth for this year and into next year. And as a result, the forward valuation based on expected earnings to be earned over the next 12 months has brought the market multiple of the S&P 500 down by a couple points from, you know, the 18 range down to the 16 range.
Which is the historical average, right?
Well, I mean, I think it's more 15 is the historical average. If you look at like the studies done by Jeremy Siegel from the University of Wharton, who's written Stocks for the Long Run, a good rule of thumb, it doesn't mean that the market's going to return this or that over the next year or so forth. But if you were to flip the forward price earnings multiple of the market into an earnings yield, that is a pretty good approximation of the real rate of return you can expect with stocks over the long run. And so, you know, if the multiple right now is 16.7 times, you know, you were to flip that over into a real rate of return of you know, 6 to 6.5% range, then all you have to do is figure what the expected inflation is. And right now about 2% inflation is priced into the treasury inflation protected versus nominal treasuries spread. So the market is implying about an 8.5% nominal rate of return over the long run. Now, it can obviously fluctuate back and forth and so forth over any given year, but that tends to be a pretty good anchor for how markets perform over the longer run.
Yeah, it tends to be with the historical average, you know, close to that 15 mm-hmm. PE. But it wasn't long ago, you know, back in January, where I was reading all sorts of papers talking about a 5% return because yeah. the multiple was 20. Right? That's the inverse earnings mm-hmm. yield.
And again, that doesn't mean that the market's going to return 5%. I think even in the late 90s, the forward expected rate of return was down to the 4% range and so forth. But during the internet bubble, as we know, from 2000 to 2002, we had a major bear market correction.
Oh, yeah.
But because of that correction, that did affect forward returns as far out as 10 years and so forth.
Yeah, and then we ended up having the Great Recession, which had a 10-year 0% return
mm-hmm.
in nominal
yes.
terms. That's my first 10 years in the industry, by the way. So, lovely start. All right, so you mentioned in one of your latest blog posts, talking about high yield, and oftentimes people are looking for income,
mm-hmm.
right? And so they're searching for what pays the most income, and naturally that's your high yield junk bonds. So you know, what's the problem with having that approach, just searching for that high yield?
Sure. So in our risk-based portfolios, where we have equity ETF equity portfolios combined with fixed income ETF portfolios, we look at portfolio risk from a total risk standpoint, meaning we don't just look at the equity risks and the fixed income risks in isolation. We want to see how they're wedded to one another, how they interact with one another. And philosophically at 3D, the reason why we don't invest in traditional high yield or emerging market debt is because we believe those two asset classes carry more equity risk than fixed income. And I think investors who are searching for yield don't appreciate the kinds of risks they're introducing to their portfolio. As they reach for yield, they're actually introducing more credit or more equity risk into their fixed income portfolio than they may be realizing. And so what we like to say at 3D is, if you want to take on equity risk, take it in your equity portfolios, don't take it in your fixed income. Now, with that said, we do invest in below investment grade, but it's in certain areas of the market where we feel investors are better rewarded given the current risk environment, but also because certain areas of the market tend to track more fixed income than they do equity. So we're, for instance, invested in senior bank loans, which are higher on the capital structure than traditional high yield borrowers or lenders. And then on the preferred side, we like variable rate preferreds because a lot of those were issued post the 2008 financial crisis by financial institutions. And the reason why they have a lower credit rating is because they're lower on the subordinate, they're more subordinated versus senior lenders. So we feel that preferreds kind of represent more of a risk of the financial system than they do general credit risk.
Okay.
But that's a big part of why we don't invest in traditional high yield EM debts, because
it's just not worth the risk, huh?
I wouldn't say it's not worth the risk, because in February 2016, we wrote what we felt was a timely piece at the time. You know, it's time to buy high yield. And that's when high yield spreads were at 8% above treasuries, which were at historically wide levels. So in essence, you were buying a call option on the market. Either the entire financial system was going to collapse again, like what we saw in 2008, or it would recover. And sure enough, we saw spreads, you know, as wide as 800 basis points or 8%, come all the way down to as low as 2.8% from the level that we saw last October. Right now, they've been gravitating between 3.25% and 3.5%. So it's not so much the reason why we wrote our latest blog piece is just an update on the high yield markets. You know, we've always been sort of cautious on high yield and emerging market debt, but you know, where we're starting to get a little more cautious now is the senior loan market, because it's benefited this year, obviously, in a rising rate environment. You, as a fixed income investor, you want short-term maturity assets that aren't as sensitive to interest rate movements, particularly in a period where the Fed is raising rates. And so bank loans have been a beneficiary of that sentiment. And I thought I saw a report out from Fitch that the senior bank loan market has surpassed $1 trillion, which is basically on par with the traditional high yield market. So it's gotten really popular, and as a result, you're starting to see underwriting standards decline. In an asset class where there's huge demand, basically, if you're the borrower, you can set more favorable terms in terms of how you borrow. So we're seeing increased issuance of covenant light loans, meaning loans with less investor protection for the lenders. And we're seeing, you know, less credit worthy borrowers come to the market to take advantage of this window that's been afforded to them, as well as more highly levered deals where the risk is greater. Typically, you see this with private equity backed deals, but the risk is greater because there's not as much equity being used to as part of the financing of that deal.
Now, a great deal, I would say the majority of my clients are in a more balanced risk approach. You know, call it a classic 60-40, right? Mm-hmm. 60 equity, 40 fixed income. There have been people talking about, you know, the demise of the 60-40 portfolio, and I think you wrote about this in one of your recent commentaries. Could you explain your thoughts on the 60-40
sure.
in the current environment?
So the January-February sell-off that you referred to earlier was the first crack in the 60-40 portfolio, because what it showed was is that in a rising inflationary environment where both equities and fixed income perform poorly, 60-40 is going to have a hard time performing well in that environment, because you're betting on two asset class, where you're investing in two asset classes that when faced with an inflation shock or an inflation surprise like what we saw in January, in the near term at least, are volatile. So you don't have with the one asset class diversifying the risks of the other asset class because they're both being hit with the same risk.
So in other words, they're now correlated rather than having zero or negative correlation.
Yeah.
And since then, right, stocks are down and bonds are down, and you know, international is down even worse than the U.S.
But the reason why we wrote about 60/40 in our May market commentary is because in late May, we saw a major sell-off in the Italian debt markets, particularly the short-term two-year debt. And it was a result of the populist government that was elected. Their choice of finance minister, who is a known Eurosceptic, was rejected by the Italian president. And in that parliamentary system, the Italian president can actually veto a proposed cabinet. And that vetoing of the cabinet person basically threw the markets in a tizzy, because the concern was is that the government would collapse and there would be new elections and they would take and Italy would take an even more hardened populist stance as a result. So you saw a major, massive sell-off in European debt, particularly in Italian debt. And that spread across the entire globe. There was kind of an initial global risk-off, as we like to say. And that showed up in a flight towards safe assets. And one of those safe assets of choice is U.S. Treasuries. And so the 10-year Treasury, which at one point had been around 3.1%, dropped all the way down to 2.7% as a result of this risk-off sentiment. So if you believe that we're kind of in a world where high debt levels can potentially cause near-term negative surprises like what we saw with Italy, the new normal demographics that we refer to, then you're going to have from time to time a flight to safety or a risk-off type of trade. And so far the beneficiary of that has been safe long-duration bonds like U.S. Treasuries. And so from that standpoint, 60/40 works in an environment where the risk of one asset class can help diversify or offset the risk of the other asset class, particularly in short-term periods like what we saw in late May.
Ben, what do you think about the second half of the year? Where are the risks and where are the opportunities?
I think the risks right now are more in the international side. We refer to a downturn in our international macro barometer, which is a compilation of business sentiment indicators, such as manufacturing sentiment across the globe, both with industrialized nations as well as emerging markets. And we've seen a notable downturn. We haven't seen a contraction, but we've seen a noted deceleration in sentiment. And you combine that with the fact that earnings estimates for emerging markets have actually turned down. They've actually peaked early in this year, and they've rolled over, unlike the rest of the world, the developed markets. Has caused us to be more cautious, I think, towards emerging markets in the near term. And then, of course, you throw in the trade war rhetoric and actual tariffs that now that are being imposed by both U.S. and China. And I think that creates a more uncertain environment, particularly for international markets. So the beneficiaries of that continue to be the U.S. market, both in equity and fixed income. The dollar is a beneficiary of that. And the U.S., unlike the rest of the world, the macro indicators still look positive. And so investors now sensing that are showing a renewed preference for U.S. equities, whereas in 2017, clearly the sentiment was in favor of international markets. So and a weak dollar. So for the second half this year, we kind of see those pressures, near-term pressures that have led to the U.S. outperforming the second quarter this year to continue. We don't see any sort of near-term risks to the U.S. growth story. We think more of those risks lie outside the U.S. And one thing that we've highlighted for several months' worth of commentaries has been what we think are the growing systemic risks coming out of China because of their high gearing or high financial leverage, especially among their banks. And we think that although China does like to try and plan for the long term, we think that their higher gearing or their higher leverage has shortened that time horizon where they're less able to absorb shocks today than perhaps they were in the past.
Hey, Ben, it's great to have you here. Thanks again for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Wow, Ben is definitely one of the smartest people that I know. It should be clear to you why we trust Ben and his team with millions of dollars of our clients' money. Thanks again to Ben for coming on the show. If you have over $500,000 in investments and you want to gain access to the UMAX platform where we have hundreds of institutional strategists like Ben, Peak is your gateway. Reach out to us at peakwm.com or you can email me directly, nick@peakwm.com. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Peak Financial Minute with Nick Hopwood. You can subscribe to this podcast through iTunes and the Android Marketplace or by visiting www.peakwm.com. Peak Wealth Management is your premier wealth management partner. Plan, protect, peak. Securities offered through Regulus Advisors, LLC. Member FINRA SIPC. Investment advisory services offered through Peak Wealth Management, LLC, a state of Michigan registered investment advisor. Peak Wealth Management, LLC is independent of Regulus Advisors.